Again, looking at the book here at this point in just a second, you might think about what we have done this week, although we have done it hurriedly. We have gone through basically the first three observations of life. And what we've done is we've seen how the writer has basically started out each one of these viewing life under the sun, and he's concluded each one by saying, from what I can tell, is just be happy. Just enjoy what God has given you. Realize good things come from Him. You're going to have to deal with some bad things along the way. You may not understand it. Just it'll be okay, though. That's been the gist of what we've seen thus far. And today, as we begin looking at this final cycle that He takes us through, we're going to begin by seeing that really, in a lot of ways, He comes to a conclusion. Hey, and we're doing things a little different today. We're going to look at the conclusion first, and then we'll see where He takes us from there. He's not done talking about life under the sun. He's not finished with that as of yet. But He's going to tell us a few more things, but before He does that, He's going to bring what He started out seeking to do to a close. So if you look here in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, and as we think about the problem that He's been dealing with all along, what we're going to see is that He says, I've made every opportunity to understand this. Look down to verses 16 and 17. He says, when I applied my heart to know wisdom, to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep, then I saw all the work of God that man cannot find out, the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. So in many ways, with these two verses, we're kind of coming to a close to the main part of the book. Because the writer is answering here, let's see, we're a little too far over. Jeff put up tomorrow's lesson. Hang on just a minute. All right, what the writer is doing at this point is basically bringing to a close what he started back in chapter 1. Okay, so kind of keep verses 16 and 17 in mind, and let's flip back and look at chapter 1, verse 13, because here is what he says he's setting out to do. All right, so chapter 1, we're going to look at it just one more time here, and look at verse 13 as far as what he says. He says, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. All right, so that's where he started. He said, I'm going to search everything out. And he has left no stone unturned, has he? He's looked at everything concerning how people try to make themselves happy. So he says that. We refer back then to chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. And what he says is this, after all of this study that I've done, applying my heart to know these things, I have determined you just can't figure out God's work. You just can't do it. And he even goes on to say, no matter how bright you are, no matter how wise you are, you cannot figure out the entirety of God's work. Now, I think that is an extremely important principle for us to get in mind, because we like to be in the know. We like to have full understanding of everything that's going on. But you think about that, what can we understand of God's work? Well, it's whatever He's told us right here in His Word. That's it. And the writer says, if you're going to try to figure out every enigma of life, if you're going to try to figure out everything that happens, you're going to be very unhappy. You're not going to be able to do it. And so his point is, God has put things in place. You can't understand all of it. Be satisfied with that. And he goes on then to make the point, we've got to be content living within the boundaries of God's law, of God's ways. We've got to have a certain amount of contentment there. And I think this is what bothers people a good deal of the time. People are not content to say, I don't understand it, but God does. And I trust in God. And so look at what mankind does. Every generation is seeking some kind of answer, some kind of solution, some kind of explanation for these things. When the writer of Ecclesiastes plainly tells us, God has given you the boundaries to live in. God has told you where things are, what to do. Be content with that. And so in many ways then, what we're finding is that the writer is sealing off at this point with verses 16 and 17. It's kind of like with chapter 1, verse 13, you put the first parentheses, and then in chapter 8, verses 16 and 17, you put the last parentheses. And he said, I started off doing it, and this is the conclusion that I've reached. That if you try to live outside of God's boundaries, you are arrogant, you are foolish to try to do so. And that's very much the gist of the book. And that's very much what he's tried to do. Now, he's going to go on just a bit further. He's not quite done with this idea before he moves on. As we move on into chapter 9 and verse 1, he's going to say, let me show you the difference between you and God. Let me show the difference between who is human and who is God. And so you look in verse 1 of chapter 9, he says, but all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God, whether it is love or hate, man does not know, both are before him. God is in control. God knows what's going to happen. God's got it figured out. He understands what's going to come as the result of all of this. Now, the writer at this point is going to broaden that out just a bit. Hey, so let's look and see what we've got so far. All right. God is in heaven. We are on earth. Respect him. Respect his ways. He continues on. Then he says, you are not God. God is all-knowing. A human is not. And now he's going to take that and he's going to give us some examples of it. And we won't be shocked at the first example he comes to. It's one that we have seen him coming to throughout the entire book, and that's the idea of death. You think, well, has the writer just got some kind of morbid fascination with death? You know, every time he's coming to it, and that's not the case at all. The reason he keeps returning to this is because this is what trips many people up. As they look at their lives, all they can see is the end of it. And if they don't believe in God, then what they're saying is when I'm put in the ground, that's it. I'm done. And if that's your view of life, you're going to be terribly depressed through your life. And so the writer here is saying, once again, let me point out to you the ideas that we find in death. Look at verse 2. It is the same for all. Since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and to the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice, as the good one is, so is the sinner, and he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. So you look at this, and once again, one final time here, he's giving us a picture of death under the sun. Doesn't matter if you're righteous, doesn't matter if you're unrighteous, doesn't matter if you're moral, doesn't matter if you're immoral, doesn't matter if you're a fool, doesn't matter if you're wise, doesn't matter if you're rich, doesn't matter if you're poor, you're all going to the same place. That's what he's telling us here. But keep that under the sun in mind. He's saying, as we look at it without God in the picture, this is what it looks like is happening. And look at what a human idea that is. Look at the contrast between transcending the sun with all God says will happen after death with what we see here. So he warns, very much like we saw yesterday. He says, you cannot seek to fill your life, his word is madness, so that you can avoid thinking about death. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that again today. I think we hit it pretty hard yesterday. But he does make the point again, so I want us to make the point again. He says, if you are seeking to fill your life with madness for fear that you are going to have a couple of minutes where your mind is at rest and you must think about death, you are just missing the point. You're living under the sun. And so once again, here he is taking us, making us look at our mortality, making us realize, I don't care how wise you are, I don't care how righteous you are, this is what's going to happen. You're going to die. That's his point. And then he goes on to make another point of life under the sun, and he talks about the advantage of the living here. And let's just note what he says as this ties in. If you look down to verse 4, he says, but he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done. All right. Three important words, finish that, under the sun. Now, here's what humans have come up with. The writer says live humans are in better shape because they know they're going to die. The dead, however, don't know anything. And that's his phrase there where he says it's better to be a living dog than a dead lion. You know, you may have lived this wonderful life, but if you're dead, you're dead. And you got this horrible life, but you're living it. You're in better shape. Why? Because you know death's coming. Now, let your mind wrap around this. This is under the sun kind of thinking. And it's under the sun kind of an explanation where he says, if this is all there is to it, that's a real problem. If this is all there is to it, the only people who are successful are those who are still alive, just simply because they know that death is coming. All right, so as he begins working toward his conclusion, I think what he's doing here is giving us another wrap-up of some of the things that he's discussed thus far. And so here, once again, is that explanation of death under the sun. But I don't think he wants to leave us depressed. Because what we're going to do is find that in the following section, he's going to give us some ideas here that are going to kind of mellow out that message. Here he's going to start telling us once again, here are some good things for you to think about, followed once again by some warnings. You know, the writer is just taking us kind of on this roller coaster. He'll get us very low with life under the sun, and then will raise us back up with his conclusion, and then once again remind us of what things are like. All right, well, we're heading up the hill right now. He's going to tell us some good things here as he talks about what we can expect as a people of God. All right, so with that being said, let's think about the conclusions that he's reached after every observation. Hey, what he said is, be content. Enjoy what you have. Realize that it's given to you from God. Okay, that's been every conclusion so far. And so here in the wrap-up, what he's saying is his life should be enjoyed. And I think one of the things that's going on here is what he's telling us is I don't want you to be depressed. I don't want you to get down and say, well, you know, if all that's going to happen to me is I'm going to die, what's the use of even going on? What's the use of even living a few more years? Now, that's under the sun kind of thinking. And the writer's not there. He's showing us, he's working us towards something much better. And so here he says, you should accept life as God gives it. You should not only accept it, but you should enjoy the life that God gives. I think there's an interesting point for us to make here. As we consider this idea of accepting this, and you might note verse 7 in regards to it. He says, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Again, sounds familiar to us. I believe the writer is saying to us, you have no right to be miserable. You have no right to sit around and say, woe is me. Why are all of these horrible things happening to me? Why is my life just falling apart? Now, he's not promoting some kind of a Pollyanna idea where everything is roses when there's problems. He's not saying ignore it. But what he's saying is don't sit around thinking about how bad a shape you're in. Don't sit around thinking, why do all these bad things happen to me? You're alive. Enjoy what God has given. That's his gift to you. Now I tell you, that can hit us pretty hard. Because as prosperous as we are as a nation, and as good a times as we live in, we tend to look for the miserable, don't we? You know, you'll talk to somebody and say, oh, I heard you went on vacation last week. Yeah, it rained every day. You know, I heard you had some time off. Yeah, I had to do my house. I had to paint my house. It was a horrible experience. You know, we just look for the negative. We just look for the bad. And the writer is saying here, God's given you a really nice gift. He's given you perhaps 70, 80 years, 90 years to live on this earth. And he's saying, enjoy it. I think he takes it a step further in the next verse. He says, not only enjoy what you've been given, but also cherish what you've been given. All right? So, a little bit of a nuance in our words here, but you might note as we go on down to verse 8, the writer says, let your garments be always white, let not oil be lacking on your head. These ideas, of course, very meaningful to Old Testament people. The idea of the white robes will be picked up in the New Testament as a sign of purity. Here, though, it's a sign almost of comfort, almost of joy. And the idea of the anointing, of course, is the feasting, the honor that's given to you. The writer is saying, God has given you a very good gift. He's given you a divine gift. Therefore, cherish what's been given to you. Don't ever treat your life like it's nothing. Don't ever say, well, you know, I don't know what I'm worth. The writer is saying here, God has given you life, and don't ignore that. Now, with that being said, he's going to take it even further with some commands for us concerning this life. Verse 9, I believe, is kind of accentuating what we found in verses 7 and 8. Where all of a sudden, it seems, just seems like kind of out of the blue, he brings marriage into it. Verse 9, he says, enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Why all of a sudden marriage? Well, I don't think it's all of a sudden. I don't think this is just some random thought that he's thrown in. You look beginning in Genesis, and you continue on throughout the Bible. You look at what the Lord says in Matthew, the other Gospels. How does God view marriage? He views that as other than the relationship with Him, the most important relationship in life. And He wants it to be a happy relationship. He wants it to be a good relationship. And if you've had or you have a good marriage, you understand exactly what he's saying, don't you? When he says, God has given you the gift of life and he wants you to enjoy it and to cherish it and to be happy in all of these things that he's given, there is nothing that's happier than a good marriage. I don't care where you live. I don't care how much money you have. If you've got a good marriage, you're going to have a good life. And so the writer is saying here, look at all these things God's given. You know, you're so worried about all of this under the sun stuff. You're tore up about death, and you're tore up about a rich man who oppresses you, and you're tore up about all of these things that are going wrong. You ever thought about looking at what's right? You ever thought about looking at the good things that he's given you? And I think what he's done is just illustrated to us here one of the most important good things within life. And so just again accentuating that point that he started earlier. Now verse 10, I guess, is one of the best known verses of Ecclesiastes. Probably first part of chapter 3 and then verse 10 of chapter 9. And I want us just to note what he says here. He says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. He's not saying we're not going to know anything in the life to come, but we're still under the sun. Okay, we're still dealing with this life. And what he says is, since you've been given a gift, don't ever approach life half-heartedly. Don't ever approach what God has given with this kind of lackadaisical idea of, you know, I might get around to doing these things someday, and you just kind of drift and meander through life. He says, whatever you find to do, do it with all your might. That is important for us as Christians. That's important for us as husbands and wives. That's important for us as parents and children. That's important for us as employees and employers. That's important for us as citizens or leaders. He says, whatever you are taking on, do it well. What kind of ethic would we find if everyone adopted this idea? This is my gift. God has given me these years, however many they're going to be, and I am going to use them as diligently as I possibly can. Now, the Lord is not advocating for us to get involved in any and everything possible. That's not his point. But what he's saying is when you approach life, you approach it in such a way that everything is done in such a fashion that it's going to be done with everything you've got. If we would observe that, the life that God has given us will be a life very well spent. And I think the writer is encouraging us in that regard. Now, with those commands, those encouragements, there's also a note of warning. Hey, he's told us a number of very good things here, but he's going to bring us back down a little bit now. He's going to remind us of some things. And so he says in these warnings, first of all, remember that life is very fragile. And we know that, don't we? We understand that we can be alive one minute and we can be gone the next. Okay? Life is very fragile. And so while the writer is saying, use the years that God has given you, you know, Put them to work with whatever your hand finds to do. Do it mightily. He says, also remember the fragility of life here. And one of the points that he's going to make with that is because you put effort in something, it does not guarantee that it's going to turn out for the best. doesn't guarantee that because you say, this is a great idea and I'm approaching it with wisdom and I'm putting my hand to it, and it's going to work out exactly like what you want. Look at verse 11. Now, this is such an important verse for us to look at. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. We see this, don't we? We see a man who is a hard worker, and he gets up and he starts at 5 or 6 in the morning and he goes till sundown, and you can depend on him and you can trust him in every way, and he's at poverty level. He's not got the money that this guy over here has, who has lied and he's cheated. So the writer says, look, when you examine life, don't think that everything's going to work out just exactly like you think it's going to. Sometimes the fastest runner trips and breaks his ankle. Sometimes you've got the man who's got the best ethic who doesn't always get the honor that he deserves. And so as we're living life, what the writer is saying is, treat it as a gift, do your very best, but don't go off course if something happens that you don't quite think is right. He's going to pursue that idea a little bit further. So he says, beware of that. As we said earlier, he says that death can intrude without warning. You know, here is someone who just looks like the picture of health. Life is over. Here is somebody who you think, you know, the guy who's got up and he runs 3 miles every morning and he eats all his vegetables and he never drinks Coke and has a heart attack. Age 50. He's gone. That's what the writer is saying here. That can come. That can happen. God may have given you a gift, but he's given you no guarantee of how long that gift is going to be. You can't count on the fact that you're going to live to be 100. You can't count on the fact that everything's going to last like you think it ought to. And so he says, just be warned. Appreciate what you've got, but don't allow this to derail you. Don't allow it to throw you off track. And I think this is a big one. And I guess he's been making this point to us throughout. In fact, I know he has. He's kind of been beating us with this point. He said, you may be wise, but it's not always appreciated. You know, you may have the good answers for everything, but it may be that not everyone appreciates that. In fact, if you look over to verse 13, he says, I have seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with men, with few men in it, and a great king came up against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor, wise man, and he is by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of the ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. So he's saying, here's a city, and this one gentleman spoke wise words, and he saved the city, and he was promptly forgotten. Do we have anything like that? I was reading a survey a while back, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was quite startling of how many Americans had no idea why July 4th is an important day. As a history teacher, that just breaks my little history teacher heart to hear things like that. You know, you ask somebody, why is July 4th a big day? I don't know. I'm not sure. Are people forgotten? You might have a few names. George Washington might still be hanging around as his name remembered. Anybody know who Nathaniel Green is? Anybody remember any of these other Revolutionary War heroes? That's what he's saying. And just like that, the wise man may not be remembered. But he says, don't let that mess you up. Wisdom's better than foolishness. It's better than weapons of war. But people forget. Sinners can wipe out a good deal of success from foolishness. Just be aware of that. All right. We're not done with that idea. But we're taking it in somewhat of a different direction. Now the writer is going to say, let me broaden that out a little bit more. Let me give you some proverbs about folly and wisdom. Let me tell you a little bit about these things just so you understand the gist of what I'm talking about. One of the things that he says is you got to make sure you beware of even a little folly. You know, here's somebody who says, well, I'm going to try to do what's right, but everybody's got to have a little fun. And by fun, they mean foolishness. You notice what he says in verse 1 of chapter 10? Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. You know, so here is this bottle of very costly ointment. Smells good. It's expensive stuff. And a fly flying over dies, drops into the bottle. It's ruined. It'll destroy its scent. It'll destroy its value. And he says, that's exactly what a little foolishness does. You know, so here's somebody who says, well, if the wise are forgotten and one sinner can destroy good works of a wise man, why should I even try? He answers that. He says what you'll end up doing is destroying something very good. And so beware of even a little folly. We all need to hear that. But on Monday, we noted how that this is a book that young people need to study. Do young people need to hear that message? You know, somebody who thinks, And I think we've got this idea kind of ingrained in our society. Well, teenagers are going to mess up. Teenagers are going to do stuff they ought not to. Why? Why do we have that idea? Should we not be teaching, don't do that? Don't You know, if we studied Ecclesiastes a little bit more with 13, 14, 15-year-olds, we might see less of a problem with the 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds. Here the writer says, just a little folly is going to mess things up. He's going to illustrate that a bit further. So he says, this is especially true when you think about leaders who are in positions of authority, who are involved in a little folly. If you look on down, you'll notice that in verse 4, where he says, if the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. The idea is, the leader is being foolish, don't you follow suit. Stay in your place, don't speak out against him, don't rebel against him, let calmness prevail, and everything's going to work out better in that regard. As well, he says if those leaders are foolish, they're going to create chaos. And he draws us an interesting picture here in verses 5 and 6. He says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. I think this is all tying into the idea of you've got a foolish leader, and he just does something crazy, just does something that's just senseless, and all of a sudden, his position on top of the horse has now been reversed. He's on the ground leading the slave who is in his place. Do we see that? How many of our leaders have we seen destroy their lives because of a little folly? An extramarital affair, a bribe that's taken, some kind of backroom dealings, and all of a sudden what you find is they have lost their position and it's created chaos within society. So he says in these Proverbs, again, beware of folly. Don't let that be a part of your life. He also tells us, and this is kind of a reiteration of what he just dealt with prior to this, he says the unexpected can always happen. And he shows this in a rather interesting way. He says, here's a man who digs a pit and he falls into it. And here's a man who breaks down a wall and a snake bites him. Now, there are some who take that as the idea of foolishness, an illustration of foolishness. Maybe so. I tend to think of it, though, in the regards of bad things can happen to you no matter what. When do accidents typically happen? It's when we're doing the mundane things, isn't it? I tell you, if I'm doing something out of the ordinary, I am typically exercising a great deal of caution. I'm following all the safety rules because I don't want it to mess up. But then something I do every day or every week, I may find myself really creating some major accident because I'm just not thinking about it. All right, and so he says, look, remember that though this is a gift from God, and though you may be a very wise person, things can happen. Accidents can occur. We know that. But he says, I want you to understand above anything else, despite all of these things that I've said about wisdom not being appreciated, wisdom is still the best pursuit. Wisdom is the way that you need to go. And so we look on down a little bit further, and we find that idea. If you look down to verse 10, I like his illustration here. He says, if the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength, but wisdom helps one to succeed. His idea here is, you know, you're chopping wood and you don't sharpen your axe, you're going to have to put a whole lot more effort into chopping that wood. You're going to have a whole lot more effort in it. Same way if you don't sharpen yourself with wisdom. You know, if you're just kind of blunt, if you're just kind of dull when it comes to wisdom, he says it's going to require a lot more effort than if you would realize the importance of it here. I like the next verse as well. As he talks about what happens, if you look on down to verse 11, he says, if the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. The idea is, get your wisdom, understand what's going on, and then do your task. Here's a guy, and he says, I'm going to charm that snake, and the snake bites him before he's charmed. And it's like, well, what good is the charming going to do then? You may can charm that snake, but you still got his venom running through you. And the idea here is, before you approach a task, approach it wisely. Hey, approach it wisely. Use the wisdom that you've developed, that you've been given, okay, so that the snake doesn't bite you first. The idea, I think, ties back here, though, to the idea that wisdom is far surpassing anything having to do with foolishness. This is a point that we're seeing change a little bit now. As he gives us this proverb, he's been talking about how the wise and the fool both go to the grave. The wise and the fool are alike in a lot of ways. Now he's showing us a distinct difference here. He says, when you think about the wise man and the fool, the wise man's words are going to be much better. Look down to verse 13. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what it is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? Okay, now take that, and let's back up to verse 12 now. The words of the wise man's mouth win in favor, but the lips of the fool consume it. As we think about this, we think about a wise man, while he's not always appreciated, while he doesn't always get the honor he deserves, his words are much more helpful. But what about the words of a fool? The writer here says the fool is multiplying his words. You ever talk to somebody like that? You ever talk to somebody who has lots to say but nothing really to say at all? And how aggravating those conversations are? That's what he's talking about here. And I think it's interesting as well. He says the fool can tell you exactly what's going to happen tomorrow. And not only tomorrow, but next month and next year and 10 years from now. He knows everything about the future. What's God said? He said, you don't know what's going on 1 second in front of you. And the wise man says, I accept the time I've been given. I live in the present. While the fool babbles on about all of these things that are going to happen in the future. So the writer tells us the wise man's words are going to be much more beneficial. They're going to be very much more helpful to you than any of these words that the fool may be speaking. Well, one other proverb that he gives here. He goes back to the idea of leaders. And he says, your land is going to be much happier if you have a wise king. And look at what he says as he kind of brings these proverbs to a close here. If you look down to verse 16, he says, woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Now let's stop there for just a minute. We'll finish it up here in a second. Again, in our political arrangement, we may not have the appreciation for this that they would have. But even with the nation of Israel and Judah, we know that there were times when a child became king. 7 years old, on the throne. He's now the leader. And you look throughout the history of the world and you find that. In Japan, for example, there were times when Japan was in its darkest days because their emperors were children and were taken advantage of. Their advisors kind of got in there and they did things the way they wanted to. And so the writer does a take on this by saying, you are in trouble if your leader is a child. Why? A child has no understanding. Now note the second thing he says there. He says, also, you are in trouble if your princes feast in the morning. The idea is they get up, and the first thing they want to do is to satisfy their fleshly needs. He says, you're in a terrible amount of trouble if that's the case. Better, though, is a king who comes from a family of nobility, who knows how to be king, who has the maturity to be king. Now, think about that even from our own standpoint. Sometimes, in fact, in recent years, We've heard a lot in our political system of, well, we want somebody completely from the outside. We want somebody with no experience in politics. Are we sure about that? Are we sure we want somebody who has never held the reins of power, running the government, making these decisions? I think that's what the writer is pointing to here. And he's saying it's much better off if you have a wise king who understands the ways of running the country, who understands the ways of kingliness. Now, what happens if you don't? Well, he gives us a fairly grim picture here. And I think in verse 18, as he's talking about the house here, he's talking about the family, the royal family. What's going to happen? He says, through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich. For the bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. So he says, you get a foolish king in, and his house is going to fall in. His dynasty is going to fall in. But what do we need to do about that? So here's a king, and he's behaving foolishly. Here's a leader, and he's acting very corruptly and wickedly, and his house is caving in. So we need to tell our friend, boy, that king is a horrible guy, isn't he? He's just so foolish and full of folly. No. The writer says, just keep your mouth closed. Because you know how we always say, a little birdie told me? Did you ever know where the origin of that was? Well, if you didn't, here it is. A bird of the air will take that to the king. Something that you think you are speaking in quietness ends up in the royal presence, and you're going to suffer for it. So again, the idea is, even though the king may be behaving foolishly, you keep yourself with all wisdom. You keep yourself where you need to be. Now, those seem like rather random ideas, but let's kind of back up for a minute and put them together. Remember, we're still basing this on the observations between folly and wisdom. And here the writer has gone through all of these various things to show us how much better wisdom is than foolishness. How foolishness may bring down a kingdom, but the wise man is going to keep his mouth. He's going to keep his lips closed. He's going to do what's right. Now we look at all of this, and in many ways what we find now is this bringing us to the end of the fourth observation of life. Right, so let's think about it this way. At this point, we are concluding everything the scientist has had in mind. All of his observations, he has tested, and he has written out for us the conclusions. As we pick up in chapter 11, however, we are working our way to the grand conclusion of the book. And so what we're going to do tomorrow is we'll pick up in verse 1, go on down through the end of the chapter, on into chapter 12, and we'll see where the writer says, after everything I've seen, let me tell you the conclusion of the matter. Let me tell you how to be happy and how to be right with God. So Lord willing, we'll look at that tomorrow and bring all of our thoughts to a conclusion. Appreciate your good attention today.